pretty amazing. Each craft stays attached for, you know, sometimes 3 months. They'll come up in one and go down in another. It's that type of thing. Usually a spacecraft will stay for 6 months attached. And that's why they need three ports on the Russian side. They always have two Russian Soyuz spacecraft, and then they'll have, something being docked either from Japan or European Space Agency or another progress ship. So they need three ports.
Okay. And one last question, that is the Dragon Falcon 9, I think you're anticipating that's the very next one that will have the capability of doing a manned launch other than the Russian Soyuz. What's your best guess, Paul, as to when Dragon will able to take human beings up and back down? Is that like a year away? 2 years away? And is that two or three people eventually?
I'll have the capability of bringing up seven if they want, but you're going to first see probably two or three, and that's going to be it. But you have a capability in that spacecraft to carry seven people. That's what we're trying for. So you're looking at probably 3 years away minimum. The only ones that might have a chance of beating them, in case SpaceX falls behind, would probably be Boeing with the CST-100. They're probably 4 or 5 years out. And Dream Chaser, I don't know. That's Sierra Nevada. I've read 4 or 5 years. I just don't see it. I mean, it looks like they're a long way from completing the spacecraft. I'm not seeing that much information on them. I mean, they're working at it, but I don't know. I'm going to guess 6-7 years, but I don't know what's going to happen. They're a long way out, I think. But I think Dragon's got the best bet, probably 3 years.
So, at least 3 more years, then, of launching with Soyuz when it comes to humans on the way up and back down to the ISS. And we do, what, about one and a half human launches per year? Is that approximately right, Paul?
Well, I just went up this week. Got a crew coming down in May, and then beginning of May, and then it'll be three people on board the space station until the end of May, and then you'll send another three up. So that's two for the year. They'll stay for roughly 3 months. They'll come back. So it looks like, probably three or four. I guess they could get in four launches per year. Probably closer to three and a half, something like that. With progress ships, they go up, quite often. Got to be about 6 a year.
So progress is bringing up new hardware and consumables 5 or 6 times per year. And Soyuz, I'm getting the impression now that 2 launches per year are guys going on the way up, another 2 launches per year, guys coming back down on Soyuz. So 4 launches per year, 2 up, 2 down. Is that a rough approximation of where we stand in the poll, K2LAW?
Well, it's like every 3 months there's a launch, and then you'll have a crew of six, and then very soon after that, three will come down, another spacecraft, and then you'll have that three-man crew for 1 month. Once you have another launch, then you'll have a 6-man crew for another time period. So it looks like about 3 or 4 manned launches up and three or four coming back down every year.
And I'm also going to guess that you get as many as 6 astronauts on board the International Space Station, because the Soyuz can only bring 3 back down, and you have to have an emergency escape procedure. During the time that there were 6 astronauts there, there must be a pair of Soyuz spacecraft docked with the International Space Station ready to do evacuation. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. Is that close to the way they play it, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
Yeah, I tried to explain that earlier. That's what I'm saying. If you were to fly up there now and take a look at the space station, you would see on the Russian side 2 Soyuz spacecraft docked. And then, you know, right now you're dragging them up. But if you would have went up a couple of days ago, you would have seen this dragon attached to the Russian side. So yeah, that's what you'll see, 2 Soyuz spacecraft. And you won't see a third one go up until one goes down, so you'll never see more than 2. So the flight rules are, how many people are up there? That's what you need as many seats to go down. You've had, when the shuttle went up, you bring up 7 people, you might have had 3 on board, so you might have had 9 or 10 people on the space station at one time. It's possible, you know, to do that when the shuttle was flying, because you had enough seats. I mean, the space station can handle that amount of people. The space station initially was being built for a permanent 8-man crew, but they eventually changed that to 6. But I remember that. So yeah, that's what you're going to have. Flight rules. Everybody has to have a chair in case the place blows up.
I think the International Space Station is now essentially fully constructed. It's my belief that no further modules are going to be added. It's as big as it's going to get. Roughly, what are the dimensions, Paul? How long? How wide? How high? I think this thing is almost the size of 2 football fields, isn't that true? In the pure area, if you look at the maximum width and the maximum length, isn't it? You're not filling up all that space, of course, but if you did, I think it's at least 2 football fields. It's a very large object. And back to you for filling in those blanks up, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW.
You've got a multi. So the Russians are launching a proton rocket at the end of the year, and it's going to be another module and for storage and things like that. It's also going to have another bathroom on board, so then you'll have now 3 bathrooms on board the space station. So that's going to attach to the Russian side. It's a pretty big module. Anytime you have a proton rocket goes up, that's a big thing. That's their big heavy lift vehicle from Russia. And if they're going to have an interplanetary flight, you'll hear the word proton rocket. So that multi-lab thing will be sent up at the end of the year. Then 2 years from now, maybe a year and a half from now, you got Bigelow Space. It's a private company. They're going to launch their own module, the inflatable one, and drop it. And it's pretty big. I mean, it's not huge, but it's a lot bigger than the Harmony node or the Unity node that they're interconnecting modules that sets up over the years to connect all these different pieces together. You know, for instance, Discovery is attached to one of its nodes. You've got the Columbus module by European Space Agency attached to another node. You've got the Kaibo module by Japan, which is probably one of the biggest ones, also attached to these nodes. Those nodes the big things in themselves, you know, maybe 18 feet long, maybe 14 foot wide, and this inflatable thing is going to be sent up about a year. That'll give them more room when we drop it. And that's the test unit for Bigelow. If that works out, eventually he'll send up modules. That will eventually become a space station, private space station. That's the plan on that. I think the space station is 1 million pounds. That number sticks in my head. As far as being as big as a football field, I would say, yeah, with the solar panels and all, probably the size of a football field. I don't think 2 football fields, because the length of one solar panel is 240 feet long by 40 feet wide. But then you've got, you know, 4 of these solar panels attached to these trusses, 11 trusses that are attached one after the other. And the length of that thing is almost 300 feet. So it's almost 300 feet of trusses long, and then you attach the solar panels to it. And then you've got attached to the trusses, you've got the modules. There's at least 10 of them, so it's like the equivalent of a 10-room flying thing up there. Big, big play stick.
Yeah, you just said something that I didn't catch on to earlier that really strikes me interesting. Bigelow is that inflatable module going to be launched in a couple of years, and I didn't realize the inflatable module is going to be attached to the International Space Station. I thought that was going to be a separate test in space all by itself. So it's going to be attached, which implies that an astronaut can now fly in between all of these individual modules, and he can therefore enter the inflatable module. And although it's very unlikely, if something really went wrong with the inflatable module, and it had an explosive decompression, and it's connected to all the other modules, and you and I know the size of that airlock between modules is so darn large that the rate at which air would flow out of there, that nothing could compensate for that. And those astronauts in a very short period of time would be in a hard vacuum. So in a worst case scenario of an explosion of an inflatable module, I think that could be awfully serious. Do you see it that way, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I read about this a couple of months ago. And they signed a deal with NASA to test one of his modules. A lot smaller than what he eventually plans on doing, but you know, he wants to really test it and have people go in it. Well, you don't want to put this thing out of space, dock with it, float inside, and not really, you know, safely testing this thing for months or even years on end. But he got a contract with NASA to do this. Sent up on one of the flights. I believe Dragon has the, in fact, I'm sure Dragon had the has the contract to bring it up. So take it out of the Dragon, the rear of the Dragon, the cargo area, and they're going to attach it to the Harmony node, and then they're going to inflate it. And it does have a, you know, 1 meter door on it. Like you said, big door, and they'll be able to open it up and go inside. Travis, they'll have you know, everything that all the other modules have. It'll have fire prevention. It'll have air conditioning, heating, you know, livable stuff inside. But then they'll close that door, and then every couple of months or every month or whatever the deal is, they'll go and open a door and go inside, and they're going to check pressures and all and make sure it doesn't leak anything. They're going to see how it does. So that's what they're going to do with the Bigelow label
inflatable is that in theory it can hold fairly compact in order for shipment. And therefore in theory you can ship a larger volumetric module in a smaller amount of launch space. That's the good news. But until it is proven, I would spend 99% of the time with the airlock door to the inflatable module being closed, and open it when you put astronauts in there for tests and whatever. But to leave it open all the time would be dangerous. On top of that, when you're about to put an astronaut into the inflatable module, and you're about to open the door between Harmony and it, I'd like to close the other door on the other end of Harmony, so that Harmony now becomes a separate module, that if in the worst case, until it's thoroughly proven out, if the inflatable decompresses, you now are decompressing the inflatable plus Harmony, and you're limiting your losses, as opposed to leaving the other door of Harmony opening, and in the worst case scenario, you lose the whole ISS. You see where I'm going on this one, Paul? I'm probably being a grandmother and worrying too much about an inflatable failing. But in the worst case failure, I worry about that. I think they were extremely lucky when that, a Progress ship that met with, can't think of the name of the Russian International Space Station, but it crashed into it, did some denting, created some leaking. And they're lucky that that amount of leak was as limited as it was. Otherwise, life would have gotten pretty dicey. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, hey. That was the Mir spacecraft. Mir means peace. Well, the Mir space station. And that was the one that was up there for 15 years. And they had a module called the Cabant. And I believe they used that for astronomy uses, and Progress came up and got a little out of hand and created a leak in there, and they were in a mad panic, and eventually they couldn't find it, so they closed it off, and that was it. Now, yeah, what they'll do will probably, I would think, with although I haven't seen anything on it, they'll probably do just what you said. They'll probably have some kind of double door system going to that module, the big little module. It should be probably no different than the Quest module or the I forget the other name that the Russians have for their EVAs, that escapes me. But, you know, we have the Quest module on the American side. When they do EVAs, you have one door, close it, you're in an airlock situation, and there's another door there. It's a double system. So, in fact, what they do is they actually stay in there now 24 hours before they do their EVAs. It's a lot easier than going through this, worrying about the bends as much as they used to. So they camp out overnight in the Quest module. But they got double doors there. They got double doors for the airlock on the Russian side.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Does the two Soyuz escape craft, which module do they dock to? I hope it's not Harmony. If the inflatable is going to be attached to Harmony, and if you want to cut off Harmony from the rest of the ISS by closing the far door on Harmony, so to speak, if your escape craft for Soyuz were also attached to Harmony, and you have a worst case decompression of Harmony because of a failure of the inflatable, you now no longer get into the Soyuz to go home. So, you told us before, and I forgot, the two Soyuz spacecraft, they're attached to which module, of Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, they have their own docking module. you gotta see what they have. There's a name for it. I think they call it the Poisk, P-O-I-S-K. I believe that's one of them, one of the docking units that they have. So yeah, on the Russian side, you know, you've got this layout. The Vesta is the main module for the Russians. So attached to it, they have like a little docking port. You know, that's where a lot of spacecraft are attached to it. And then you have the functioning cargo block. It's also by the Russian. There's a Russian name for that. And you got to go down this long line. Attached to that, you have Unity. Unity attaches to the American side, which is Destiny. And then from the Destiny, it goes to another module, another node, and they call that Harmony. Drop it. So attached to Harmony is the PMA. They have PMA 1, PMA 2. These are the docking ports that the shuttle has docked up against. So to understand what the Unity is, take like a cube, and you now have 6 ports on this cube. So on the run, you might have Destiny on one side. On the other side, you might have the Columbus attached to it, or you might have I could actually give you the exact layout how they work it, but then coming out of the top, they'll have a Z1 structure attached to it, which attaches to the truss system. Below that, you might have the cupola where they're looking out the windows. These six-sided units are called nodes. So that's what you have, and you have two nodes up there. You have Unity, the first one that went up. So that dock between the Russian functioning cargo block and the Destiny, that's number one. We drop it. After the Destiny, they had another node, and that's called the Harmony. Coming out of that thing, they have on one side, you've got the Columbus module from your European Space Agency. That's there, like home. Just like Destiny is out of the American home. And then out of the other side, you've got the Japanese Kaibo structure coming out of that. You've got another module. That's the Japanese version of their home and their scientific research. Now, at the front of the Harmony, you've got this PMA adapter, they call it there. And that's where our Dragon attaches to, or Space Shuttle used to attach to. You've got the American side, and you've got the Russian side. You've got at least three ports for the Russian side, and two for the American side.
Okay, I'm still concerned, Paul. I'm drawing myself a picture of all these modules you talked to me about. Vesta, functioning cargo block, Unity, Destiny, Harmony, PMA, in one of the strings. If the inflatable module is attached directly to Harmony, and if my escape pods are attached to the PMA, I have to walk through Harmony to get to the PMA, to get to the escape pods, the Soyuz. So if the inflatable does get directly attached to Harmony, and if it created a decompression, I can no longer go through Harmony because I'm now in a vacuum. I can't get to the PMA, and I can't get to the escape pods. Maybe I'm worrying too much, but do I have the diagram wrong, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, you have two PMAs attached to the Omni. One coming out of the front, maybe one coming out of the bottom. I'm trying to remember. But, so it attached, a PMA is basically, it's like a long cone type of thing. You've got two doors on it. So even when the shuttle is attached to it, you'd have to open up one door on the PMA side and then the other door on the Omni side to get in. Before Omni was there, by the way, this whole PMA setup was attached to Unity. And so you would, before Destiny was even there. And you would have, you know, you would dock to the PMA and go into the Unity. As it was being built, they would move the PMA. I mean, that's what a lot of this spacewalking stuff was about, too. You'd have the arm of the ISS disconnect this PMA module, which is a big thing, and move it further down the line, you know, as it was being built. You know, you'd have Unity up and then disconnect the PMA from that, and you would attach Destiny. Then the other end of Destiny, you should attach the PMA again. And then as the Harmony module came up, that would be attached. You'd have to move the PMA, put it somewhere, and eventually it would be attached in front of the Harmony. So then you might have two ports dedicated to docking. And you would, you know, so if one decompresses, you can still get out the other door, you might say, the other port, which would be connected to your escape route, your Dragon spacecraft. Or you go the other way, you get onto the Russian spacecraft, no problem. So it's that kind of a layout, Dick. Figure all these ports, you're going to have one. It's not going to be in the run of this whole thing.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, once again, Paul, the two Soyuz, I'm going to call them escape craft. If something goes wrong and I got to come home, I'm going to climb into a Soyuz. The two Soyuz, one or two Soyuz spacecraft, are attached where to the ISS? Over to you, Paul.
That's the Russian end. They have, they have ports coming off of there in between their units. Russian is what I think we call the POISK, P-O-I-S-K. They have docking modules attached to their end of it. Similar to the PMAs. It's weird because, you know, the way everything was designed, you can't take a Russian Soyuz spacecraft and dock it to the American side. They're not compatible. So the Russian side, they've got three of these ports somewhere along that front. And think of it, like all these ports, of course, aren't in series. You've got three outlets somewhere along that line. It's like different parallel. If one is becomes disabled, you still have the other one to go to.
Okay, now I feel more comfortable. Up till now, you told me the docking ports are on the PMA, and the PMA is connected to Harmony. And I made the mistake of thinking that Soyuz was attached to docking ports PMA. It's on the other end, way back there at Vesda or POISK is where the Soyuz is. So, therefore, you close the right airlock doors and you can keep everything separated here. Okay, it makes me feel a little more comfortable. I think there has been a YouTube video-like thing where they opened up a whole lot of series doors, and so a camera was mounted on the shoulder of an astronaut, so to speak, and he did a internal flight from one end to the other of the International Space Station. So if you're going in one long linear line with all the airlocks open, that's quite a few modules and a lot of feet, isn't it? We're talking about hundreds of feet here. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Oh, yeah. with the volume of a 747. You line up a bunch of soda cans, and you go from one end to the other. You got the Russian Vesna, that's living quarters, bathrooms and stuff. Then you got the functioning cargo block after that. Then you've got a unity join type of thing, they call it. It's the node. And coming out of that, I'm going along one long run now. And then come out of that unity node, and you go right into the American destiny. And then keep going along that run, and now you come to Harmony, the other node, the other six-port connecting thing. And come out of the front of that, and you come to a docking port called the PMA. So that's basically your long run. And now you can go left and right on some of these things. You've got now we'll go from one end to the other from the American side. You come out of that same Harmony node, and you can go 90 degrees. You can go left or right. So if you go left, you open the door, and now you're not on the run of the whole space station. You go left, and you're into the Columbus module. Big thing. Let me drop it. So opposite of that, 180 degrees from that, and now you come out of that, again, out of Harmony, and you're into the Kaibo. That's like 30 feet long. And then from Kaibo, you can go straight up. They've got another adapter, another little room attached to that. You can go forward of that, and you're going to go out of space, but that's where they've got a porch. The Japanese got a porch on that thing with their own robotic arm and all. So now you come back into Kaibo, back into the Harmony, and travel back through Destiny again. Now I'm going along the run, and now you wind up back in Harmony, the original, back in Unity, back in the original node. Now you go left from there, and you wind up in the Quest Lab, and that's where you would get out. You would start getting ready to do a spacewalk, another big room. Go back now. Turn around. Go back into the node Unity, and 180 degrees from that. You keep going the other way. You're gonna wind up viewing Earth. You're gonna be looking at the. You're gonna be in a cupola type of deal, looking straight out. So you have that. In these places, you have a bathroom on the American side, a bathroom on the Russian side. And by the end of the year, you'll have another bath and another brush in the spring. That other thing I told you about earlier. That's pretty much it. Dick, back to you.
Wow. I wonder how literal you were when you said it's the length of a 747 passenger interior. How many pounds per square inch is the air pressure in the ISS? And I think there's a much lower pounds per square inch of a spacesuit, because you have to operate those joints, and as you use too much pressure, you can't fold the joints anymore. I'm going to guess the spacesuit runs on pure oxygen at 5 pounds per square inch. Let's see, it could be three or four pounds per square inch if it's pure oxygen, whereas the ISS itself, I'm having a little trouble believing it runs at the full 14.7 pounds per square inch, but maybe it does. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, they keep the ISS at 14.7. Nitrogen, same ratio as what we have here with on Earth. That's what they have, 14.7. The space station has that. The shuttle, they have 10.7 on a regular basis. 10 point something, roughly around 10, I forgot. Then they used to have to equalize when they dock. Years ago, I remember the early flights, they were always 5 pounds per square inch, pure oxygen. The reason they could do that now, instead of 14.7, now you're down to 5 pounds, but it's all oxygen, so you get the same amount. You're breathing the same amount of oxygen that you would at 14.7. Now, I remember not too long ago, I was at a, I think it was a Hubble mission. The guy was talking about the pressure in the suits. They've got them down to 3, I believe. They're down to 3 pounds, which is better because you can open and close your hands a little bit. Very tiring on your hands with the gloves. So I think they're down to 3. Back to you, Jeff.
Yeah, the 3 makes some sense because 21% or so of the atmosphere on Earth is oxygen, which is roughly 1/5 of our atmosphere is oxygen. The rest is nitrogen and trace gases. So if I go 5-1 lower than 14.7, call it 15, I'm down to 3. So pure oxygen at 3 pounds per square inch. A human being, at least his lungs are happy. The rest of his body, I don't know. You start going to very low pressure, and boy, you can easily get bends in the joints. And I guess that's why an astronaut has to dwell for 24 hours at 3 or 5 pounds per square inch pure oxygen in order to get all the nitrogen out of his joints before going into the suit. That strongly suggests that you don't put on that suit in an emergency operation. My guess is the full procedure to put on that suit gotta take you at least an hour or two. Is that true, Paul, for the US2N, K2LAW?
Oh, yeah, well, no, it does take a long time. But, you know, they've shortened the time for quests anyway when they do a spacewalk because they do spend, they camp out in the quest lab. You know, the two that are going to go out will do that for 24 hours. They change the level of the nitrogen in their system by doing that. Lower pressure. So they don't have to make that drastic of a change when they go from 14.7 down to 3 or the other way around going up. And, yeah, the docking units, they call them, for the Russian side. I believe that's the name. But, they've been doing this a long time. We've been covering this a long time, Dick, but not much has changed as far as the pressure goes. The only thing I remember why it was a bad problem was when they had the fire at the pad, the Apollo 1 fire. They didn't run 5 pounds of pressure, or 10 pounds. They ran 14.7 plus 5 pounds of pressure, or pure oxygen in that thing, and then they wonder why the thing burnt up. That was bad. They ran like almost 20 pounds of pressure of pure oxygen. That was bad news.
How many pounds per square inch does a Soyuz fly at, Paul? Go ahead.
I would guess they're probably 10 pounds. I think that was the general flight pressure. Even for the shuttle, I'm trying to remember. I think the shuttle was 14.7 as well, and then they would drop it down to 10 if they were going to do a spacewalk. You know, for the whole crew, and then of course they have they had 2 doors there, so they had the ability to separate the 2 that were going to go out. I don't know for sure, Dick. But I remember that fire on the pad on Apollo 1 that killed the 3 astronauts. The only reason they had a real big problem is because they wanted a positive pressure inside the spacecraft. They would have normally ran 5 if they went out of space, you know. Because they wanted a positive pressure, and you had 14.7 outside, they decided to run it at 20 pounds pure oxygen. And one little spark, that thing went up real quick. Well, they don't do that stuff anymore. Except on, the only people in pure oxygen are the ones in the spacesuit.
Yeah, Chaffee, White, and Grissom. We lost on, I think it was called Apollo 1, roughly, what, 1967, on the launch pad as a practice, and running under high power, pure oxygen. And I think the best analysis was that a socket wrench was left under one of the seats to cut through the wiring, and the wiring was inflammable. A bad combination. Flammable wiring, short circuit, and high pressure, pure oxygen. That not only burns, it almost explodes under those conditions. And a really bad accident. A lot of lessons learned on that one. And afterwards, somebody can say, gee, what were we thinking? There was no quick way of opening the hatch. I think it had to be opened by opening bolts. There was no explosive bolts. And that kind of an environment certainly is not safe. I'd like you for any comments on that, Paul, and I guess we got to move on. We've had quite a space session tonight. And by the way, I will pass it over to anybody else who's got any further questions for Paul. We've had a good session tonight. I've now got a diagram for the first time of almost the layout of the International Space Station. My goodness, a lot of modules, a lot of launches, because each one of these modules, I'm guessing, is 2,000 pounds or so, isn't it, Paul? WS2N, T2LAW.
Yeah, modules and the trusses and whatever. 11 trusses, you know, put them all together in one big long line, and, you know, it's the frame of all thing. And then, who knows what the solar panels weigh, you know, wow. It's a massive thing. Well, you see when they do the spacewalks. It's incredible. So, it was, there's a couple of NASA videos that you could see with the, you know, they actually have an astronaut, I thought, I forget his name, and he did a good job. He went to all the modules. They all weren't up yet at the time, but most of them went to, he was in Columbus, he was in the Kaibo unit to Japan, and he went through Destiny, and he went all the way to the other end, to the Russian Soyuz spacecraft, and incredible. I mean, and there's computers all over, laptops all over everywhere. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. They told me there was 20, 30 computers up there. Every room he went into, there were computers on the ceiling, on the floor, everywhere. Incredible. It's a pretty good video. It went on for about 20, 30 minutes.
One of the very rough estimates you gave us in the beginning, Paul, is that the International Space Station is in the vicinity of 1 million pounds. And if each launch of a space shuttle can take up a couple of thousand pounds, my goodness, that's a lot of launches to get 1 million pounds there. Not all of it was shuttles, but you know what I mean. Wow. So all of that kinetic energy of all of those rockets launching all of those modules, speeding up every one of those modules to 17,500 miles an hour to put them in that low Earth orbit. All that hardware is there, and it's moving. 25,000 feet per second. What is that to? In miles per second, that's what? 5 miles per second? It's moving 5 miles per second. 1 million pounds of it. That is the most amount of energy that has ever been put into one thing that I can think of, other than the total stored energy in Lake Michigan, if you know what I mean, before it goes through a Niagara Falls. All of that has to come back. In theory, someday, the International Space Station will say, hey, it's beyond useful life, it's time to bring it back. Can you imagine the procedure of bringing back that much hardware? Can't be done in one chunk. There's got to be multiple deorbits as I see it. Because if anything goes wrong with 1 million pounds moving at 5 miles per second, that's almost a meteor hitting the Earth, the pole. I'm exaggerating a little bit. WS2N, K2LAW.
Two-eater again. Trying to hard again. Well, okay, we'll save that for tomorrow.
they did that and they priced it up. I mean, it's nowhere near this, this thing. Probably four or five times as big. Go off of it, burn it up over the Pacific. That's what they just did with Mir.
So you're saying Mir was brought back all in one chunk, and you're predicting the International Space Station will be brought back all in one chunk. I'd like to believe we're going to use it at least 10 more years. Have they said words along those lines, Paul? Go ahead.
Originally it was a 15-year deal, starting in, it was supposed to start in 2000, a little bit before that, I think, but it actually started around 2000. I think the first flight was 1999, first two pieces that went up. The functioning cargo block by Russia and the Unity module, node by the United States. They docked 1999, and they talked about 15 years out from there. So then they said, well, at completion, it will be 15 years. So that was about a year or two ago with the last. Well, about last year or so, a year and a half ago, for the last shuttle mission, 15 years out. Then they said, well, at completion, well, officially it's not completed. They're going to bring another module up at the end of the year by Russia. So that would be at least 15 years from the end of this year. You know, they're going to keep it 20, 25 years.
That makes sense. We've made a big investment in hardware, people, whatever. And I keep coming up with, I think, is the last question, Paul. We're getting a lot of space research out of this. We're finding out long-duration human exposure to microgravity, what it does, bone losses, muscle loss, whatever, rates, protective procedures, all of that. When it comes to scientific discoveries of building exotic materials in zero-G and whatever, NASA normally talks about a lot of fallout from all of their projects. Can you think of specific scientific fallouts of the International Space Station? WS2N, K2LAW.
Another couple of hours, but in that we don't have it, Dick. But it's a little bit of science to bring it back. Even Dragon that just came back this week brought back investigation for further electronic microelectronics. Big test on that just came back. There's more biological tests for long duration space, you know, physical things on board. There's a geology test that come back. I mean, they got a lot of weird things that are coming back that eventually get developed. Some kind of a thing that came back on Dragon that had to do with extending their food supplies on long duration missions. Some kind of a high tech thing that they've been working on for years up there. They brought that back. Each mission that goes up or comes down, once it gets here, it gets into the scientists' realm. You know, you might not see results from 3, 5, 10 years out, but things are being developed. Yeah, it's well worth it, Dick.
I agree. Hey, Paul, good stuff. Anybody got any further questions for Paul? Before we end this, this is one of the longest space sessions we've ever had, but I've gotten a lot of good information out of it. Anybody else got any further questions for Paul? Give me your call letters right now. K2LAW in the Tech Man. Okay, one of the things that I've been threatening you guys for a long time is this thing about a microwave oven. One very interesting experiment you can do with your microwave oven is to take an ordinary 8-ounce glass of water, put it in the microwave oven, run it full power for 60 seconds, and with the right kind of a thermometer, you've got to be a little bit careful with the thermometer, some metal thermometers I think would interfere with the microwaves a little bit, but there are certain kinds of thermometers made to be microwave oven safe. I own one of those. And when I put 8 ounces of water in my microwave oven, in 60 seconds, it'll heat at 55 degrees Fahrenheit. So if I started off at 70 plus 55, I end up with what, 125 degrees Fahrenheit. So I get roughly 55 degrees rise of roughly 8 ounces of water. I did a more exact experiment. I don't have the figures in front of me. And that's what happens in 1 minute. You calculate what that means because each gram of water requires 1 calorie to change 1 degree centigrade, is it? Yeah, I think it's 1 calorie, 1 degree centigrade for 1 cubic centimeter of water, if I got that right. And so I know how many cubic centimeters of water I had. I know how much temperature rise. I can convert the Fahrenheit to centigrade and so on. And the answer comes out 800 watts. In other words, my microwave oven will pour 800 watts of real energy into an 8-ounce glass of water. And by the way, if I put a 4-ounce glass of water in there, and I did the calculation, instead of getting 55 degrees rise, I'd get 110 degrees Fahrenheit rise. Because the way the microwave oven works is that magnetron is going to put out 800 watts into that oven. That energy is going to bounce between those thoroughly lossless, highly conducting walls until something absorbs it. And there's only two things in that little...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's only two things in there that can absorb the energy. The water, and if there isn't a good load in there like water, some of the energy comes back to the magnetron tube itself. That little probe in there, which is the antenna launching the energy into the chamber, well, that becomes the energy, that becomes the antenna that receives the energy after it bounces off the walls. It'll come back to the magnetron. So you run a microwave oven empty, you're pouring an extra 800 watts, in my case, 800 watts of dissipation into that magnetron, and there's a good chance you're going to damage it in the process. So now you've got some idea as to why 8-ounce glass of water is a very good dummy load for the oven. And with the 8-ounce glass of water, because I can easily calculate, I can measure the height and the width of the glass, and I assume that it is a flat absorbing surface. I figure out how many square centimeters it's got. The 800 watts going into my water turns out to be something in the vicinity of 8 watts per square centimeter. That's the power flux density that my microwave oven will give to an 8-ounce glass of water. Roughly 8 watts per square centimeter is the amount of power going into that area. In reality, the energy is bouncing left, right, up, down, whatever. But if you make the simplified assumption that all the energy is going into the water from one forward surface, and I know what the area of that surface is, it calculates to be 8 watts per square centimeter. Can we drop? You guys have been hearing for about a month and a half that about a month and a half ago, I chose a whole bunch of little bitty candy bars that I had from the Christmas holiday. Milky Ways and Mars and Mounds and whatever. Chocolate bunnies and so on. A whole bunch of various kinds of candy bars. Hershey pure chocolate. Hershey chocolate with nuts and so on. I put those candy bars, about 4 at a time, on a piece of foam with some wax paper underneath, just in case it melted. Didn't want to dirty up my foam. A piece of very low-density foam, the kind of foam, the blue foam that's used for insulation on houses. I think it was a 2-inch thickness piece of it. I would guess it's about a 4-inch square. I put that in the microwave oven alongside of the glass of water and put about 4 or 6 of these candy bars at a time. And altogether, I think I checked about 10 or 12 kinds of candy. And the bottom line was, anything with pure chocolate, 8 watts per square centimeter, 800 watts in that oven, for 60 solid seconds, nothing happened. Pure chocolate, whether it be a chocolate bunny or a Hershey bar with nuts, nothing happens. It stays ice cold. Let me drop. A couple of the candy bars did experience a small amount of melting. Only the ones that contained nougat. I seem to remember Milky Way did it. Nougat really means that there is a mixture in there of milk and egg white mixed together. Anything that contains water, egg white and milk both contain water. So anything that contains water absorbs the microwaves and gets hot, and I saw a small amount of melting. but it took 800 watts into the oven, 8 watts per square centimeter of flux density power going into the candy bar for 60 solid seconds to give a small amount of melting. So I did get a couple of candy bars that melted. Chocolate Kisses, as I remember, which are pure chocolate, nothing happened. Of all the brands of Chocolate Kisses I had, one of them was somewhat nougat-like, and I did get experience a little bit of melting. So I saw a little bit of melting at that extremely high power level on a couple of kinds of candy bar. And I checked lots of kinds of candy bar. Now let me show you what that 8 watts per square centimeters means. It should alarm the daylights out of somebody. Let me show you why. For an unprotected environment, the current international standard, the National Institute of Science and Technology, the C95 report, American National Standards Institute, that's what I'm trying to think of. The C95 report tells you that for an unprotected environment, in other words, where the potential victim doesn't know he's being exposed to RF energy, we're expecting numbers like 1 milliwatt per square it's 1 milliwatt per square centimeter is what we're trying to keep it down to. I think in some cases it goes down to a 0.1. So around 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. For a whole lot of years it used to be 10 milliwatts per square centimeter is the maximum. And as you probably heard me say once before, where did that come from? It came from the test they did on the red eye of a white rabbit. They clamped the poor animal into a fixture, held his eye open with clamps. He couldn't move his head, he couldn't move his eye, and you start squirting microwaves at him. And you eventually found out that 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, he will develop a cataract. And so they took that threshold of cataract genesis, divided by 10 in the old days, came down to 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, knowing a human being is not going to sit steady with staring into a microwave oven, so to speak, for a open-ended waveguide for 6 solid minutes with his eye open, so that cutting it down by 10 to 1 and knowing the human being is moving and he can sense temperature, you know that that's a relatively safe number. So let's take the old safe number, 100 milliwatts per square centimeter. That's 0.1 watt per square centimeter. My oven with that 8-ounce glass of water gives 8 watts per square centimeter, 80 times higher than the amount of power that will give a human being a cataract. My microwave oven runs an amount of power 80 times above the power that can create a cataract. And with that amount of power, 80 times above cataract genesis, I get a little bit of melting of some candy bars. Do you want to believe that Percy Spence, the guy who supposedly invented the microwave oven, had that amount of power going into his body to melt his pork chocolate bar in his pocket, 80 times the amount that gives him a cataract? Do you want to believe that? You can tell I do not. That story is an urban legend. It sounds good. There's something very wrong with it. We've run out of time. This was Tech Fed number 1443. There's a little more to that story, but you got the gist of it. I think we've had a good session. We'll be back next week. Be kind to each other. And John, over to you for any comments. KC2WGV, before we get cut off, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's coming soon. Got great net. A lot of good space information tonight. I like that. So, we'll be back next week, Willem, and we'll have fun. You guys be safe out there. KC2WGV.
73, Dick, John, everybody else. Hope you had a good Easter. And, by the way, there's 3 nodes. There's also we'll go over it in detail one of these days about the whole layout of that space station.
Good night, Paul.
Fantastic, Paul. Fantastic. I'm amazed that you're able to memorize all of that. In order to get through, I'm coming through the other way. Bye-bye for now, and thank you, Paul. K2RIW.
Oh, heartfelt thank you once again from your friends in Canada. Hope you had a happy Easter and a pleasant weekend.